Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here. Welcome to the Lowy Institute's Canberra home, the National Gallery of Australia. I'm Sam Roggeveen, a senior fellow at the Lowy Institute. Thanks for coming out on such a cold, wintry Canberra night. I know we didn't make things easy for you with the obstruction at the driveway there to the gallery. It almost undid me as well. In a moment, I'm going to introduce our guest, Anthony Bubalo, more formally. But for now, can you please give him a warm welcome? Thank you, Anthony, for being here. So we're here tonight to launch the eighth Lowy Institute paper since we relaunched this series in collaboration with Penguin in 2014. The Lowy Institute papers are the Institute's flagship publications. Twice a year we publish these peer-reviewed long essays or research papers on key international issues affecting Australia and the world. And across from me sits the founding editor of the Penguin Lowy Institute paper series, Anthony Bubalo. And as luck would have it, across from Anthony sits his successor, which is to say me. And I'm proud that Anthony's paper is the first one that I've edited. Anthony Bubalo is a principal at the consultancy firm Naus Group, where he focuses on the defence and security sector. Until just a few months ago, Anthony was Deputy Director and Research Director at the Lowy Institute, where he worked for 14 years since the Institute's founding. Anthony's produced research on a variety of Middle Eastern issues. He comments on Middle Eastern politics for the media here and internationally. Before joining Lowy, Anthony was an officer in the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, and he served in diplomatic missions in Saudi Arabia and Israel. And he was also a Middle East analyst with the Office of National Assessments from 1996 to 1998. Now, ladies and gentlemen, the format tonight is straightforward. I'm going to start by asking Anthony a few questions about his paper. I'll open the floor to you for all of your questions. The idea is for the session to run for about 45 minutes, after which we'd love you to join us for another drink just outside the theatre. So, with the preliminaries done, Anthony, let's kick off. I want to ask you just to open this up by describing the premise behind this Lowy Institute paper. You argue that the Middle East is at a point of transition. Of course, societies are always evolving. So tell us, what makes this period so special in Middle East history?
Thanks, Sam. Before I answer your question, let me just say first what a pleasure it is to be here. And what a pleasure it is to be on the other side of the table, presenting my paper rather than being the interviewer. It was a great pleasure to write the paper, and I'm very pleased to see so many friends, old friends here tonight, who braved the cold and the wind and the obstructions to get here. So thanks for coming. So what prompted the paper? Partly was looking back on really kind of 25 years focusing on the Middle East in a variety of capacities, both in government and outside government. And really focusing in on a period, as I argue in the book, of transition or transformation in the region. And Sam's right. You can say that society is always in transition, but I think what we are seeing in the Middle East today in a qualitative way is something that is more than the usual disruption, more than the usual periodic outbursts of conflict and crisis. This is akin to the period at the end of the Ottoman and colonial empires, where the Middle East transitioned to the modern region that we lived with for most of the 20th century. Now, there's lots of evidence for that, and it's not a particularly contentious thing to argue that amongst kind of Middle East watchers that the region is in transition. But one of the things I wanted to kind of emphasize in the book, and this is why the first half of the book, if the book is called The Remaking of the Middle East, the first half could be subtitled The Unmaking of the Middle East, because I talk there about the way in which the old order, the old system of government, and I use the Arabic term Nizam, the system, and I use that basically to apply to more or less every state in the region, because even though there are important differences between states, there's enough similarity in the way that they run the way that, whether they're republics or monarchies, the way that they govern, whether the way that they've governed since their independence, since the modern Middle East emerged, to talk about as one system. And the way, and what I talk about in that first half of the book is the way that system has decayed. And it's that decay that has produced the current moment of transition. Question being, of course, transition to what?
Yeah. So talk a little bit more about that decay of the Nizam, because I must say, as when I read this, I thought to myself that the idea of the Nizam is really at the core of the book, and I thought for a generalist reader it was terrific that you took, I think, a brave decision to generalize in that way. I think a lot of specialists would have got their backs up and said, oh, but there's too many differences between
they
countries.
Did. Yeah,
I know they did. But I think it was a great decision, and it works brilliantly. But tell us more about what is this old system, and why is it now at the point of decay?
So one of the reasons I used this, and it's really a device, but I think it's one that certainly applies, is one of the famous slogans of the Arab uprisings was Ishab yurid iskat al-Nizam, the people demand the overthrow of the regime or the system. This was chanted from Tunisia through to Yemen. And it was significant because people were not just, what they were looking for was not just another economic handout or a lessening of repression. They wanted the system to change. But what really kind of made me reflect on it was a couple of months after the Egyptian uprising, I recount this in the book, I was sitting in a cab in Cairo trying to get from the airport to my hotel. And as anyone that's been in Cairo will know, the traffic in Cairo is terrible, but it had gotten even worse because when the parts of the security state collapsed, one thing that disappeared were all the traffic cops. And I was a bit loath to tell a taxi driver story, lest I be accused of being, you know, Tom Friedman-like. But nevertheless, it was an important story because at one point, the taxi driver turns to me and with this incredibly weary look on his face and says, "Mafish Nizam, there is no system." Now, he meant it probably in the context of there is no order, but I think it equally applied to what had happened, at least momentarily in Egypt. The system had ceased to kind of function. And for me, it really kind of resonated. So I started thinking about what is it that makes the system in the Middle East distinct? And very crudely, and again, alighting over lots of differences between countries, you know, since independence, most states in the region were run in a fairly top-down fashion. And that doesn't just mean autocratic rule, but it was a state-driven development process. Most regimes, whether monarchies or republics, ruled by a combination of coercion and co-option. Now, this is really important because often the stereotype of the Middle East is that these autocrats rule by coercion alone, and I think that's wrong. In fact, they tend to use coercion very selectively. Mm. So mostly they co-opted people either by providing, via the social contract, jobs or subsidized food, subsidized fuel, education, healthcare. Or by providing a national ethos or ideology around which people could rally. And then for that small group of people that still weren't happy with that deal, you use coercion. Now, that model certainly was initially very successful in the kind of 50s and the 60s, partly because the resources that states had were great, whether they had discovered oil or whether they had, as a function of the nationalization of kind of state assets, they had new assets to kind of deploy. Also, populations were smaller, expectations were lower. Suddenly, people that had no healthcare or no education were getting healthcare and education. And then in the 70s and the 80s, as this deal started to become very expensive for the state to maintain, they got a boost as a result of the oil boom in the kind of the 70s and the 80s. So you either had oil-producing states that got, you know, tremendous rents from increased oil incomes, or you've got states that didn't have, big oil resources, but who sent their workers to work in countries that did, and the remittances that came back to the state helped keep the deal alive. By the 1980s, however, that deal started to fray, and some of the regimes understood that, so they started undertaking processes of largely kind of neoliberal economic reform. The problem there was even though in some cases some of the middle classes were made bigger, mostly it was the kind of the crony capitalists around the regime that benefited. So basically through the 80s and 90s, the basic economic model of the Nizam was collapsing. At the same time, and for me it was never just an economic equation. You also have the degree to which the state is not meeting the aspirations of people. So one of the great slogans of the uprising was not just the demand for aish, for bread, but also for karama, for dignity. Mm-hmm. And one of the interesting things there is that one of the negative consequences of the kind of economic reforms that many of these countries went through in the 80s and 90s is that it really increased inequality in them. So you had a situation where, even up to the uprising, a place like Egypt was, the economy was growing at, 6, 7, 8%. Yet there were people who, as a result of that economic growth, who were middle class, who had aspiration, but could see this new wealth around them, but were not able to access them. There are a couple other elements to the decay of this system. That over time, and particularly in the beginning of the first two decades of this century, the way in which the US role as a prop to many of these regimes began to decline. The quality of leadership, the quality of leadership in the region. Yes, most countries have always been ruled by autocrats, but some of the founding autocrats had some guile, had charisma, had ideologies that they used to mobilize people. But by the time you hit this century, as I say in the book, muddling through it pretty much become the mean. Lots of old, uncharismatic leaders, not particularly dynamic, not able to kind of mobilize people anymore. Now, the important point here is, and one of the reasons why I spend so much time in the first part of the book dealing with the decay of the old order is that this did not happen overnight. We have this tendency to kind of look at the Middle East and decide, make judgments after 6 months or a year or 2 years. So, there's this sense that, really the roots of the Arab uprising were very kind of recent, when in fact the decay that the decay of which the Arab uprisings and other things that have happened in the region were all symptoms started many decades ago. And that's also why this decay is irreversible, and this decay has created this moment of great transition in the region.
So that's the first half of the book. The second half of the book is where you introduce the idea of green shoots. Mm-hmm. So can you talk more about that? Simple question. What are the main green shoots that you've identified?
Yeah. So the green shoots thing is an interesting one for someone like me who by inclination is a dark-hearted pessimist. So the very idea of writing...
I sound like they know you, Anthony.
Yeah. the very idea of writing something which points to, positive things happening in the Middle East kind of ran very much against the grain. But I also thought that in deciding to write something in the Middle East, to reflect on 25 years working and travelling in the region, and particularly at this moment, the one thing that the world doesn't need now is another catalogue of the Middle East dysfunction and miseries. And that's not to say that everything that's going wrong in the region isn't also happening, but that there are also things alongside that are also happening in the background and that we don't notice. I remember when I was lived in Cairo in the early 90s, when I was doing language training, it was a period when extremist jihadists were targeting tourists and Westerners in terror attacks. And I still remember getting these phone calls or letters from friends saying, are you down in a foxhole? Are you, are you constantly dodging bullets and bombs? And of course, the reality in Cairo was very different. It was, you hardly ever saw it. And, traveling around the region, even with all the turmoil that's been going on recently, life still does go on and there are positive changes. Now, the other reason why it's important, I think, to identify changes now is that at a moment of transition, when the old structures are weakening or decaying or in some cases collapsing, it's precisely that moment that new structures and potentially positive growths actually have a chance. Much more so than in periods where the existing order is stable or even earlier when it's kind of dynamic and effective. So, you know, that was the general idea that I would go to the Middle East and I'd do reading over the course of the year, trying to identify green shoots.
And so to get a bit more specific, my sense in the second half of the book is that despite the way you describe the decay of the old system, these green shoots are not so much coming up in open defiance of the old system, rather they're working around that system, or under or over.
So I say that, it's literally some of these green shoots are growing through the cracks of the old system. Some of them are capitalizing on the fact that the old system is weak. So, one way to look at this is you look at the Arab uprisings and, you look at somewhere like Egypt and you can ask, well, why is it that Mubarak was overthrown? Was Mubarak overthrown because the movements that got people onto the streets, that mobilized people, were particularly strong and effective? And I think they were. Or was it more that it reflected Mubarak's weakness, the fact that he was, he was old, he was doddery, he'd lost that kind of, the regime had lost its dynamism. And I think that was also a factor. So in a sense, both forces worked, with these newer forces exploiting the weakness of the old regime. You know, if those kind of things had happened 10 years earlier, in all likelihood, the regime may not have been overthrown. So yes, they are growing up in part through the cracks in the old system. It's not guaranteed that they'll continue to grow, but they have a chance now, whereas in previous years they might not have.
So let's get specific. Let's talk, for instance, about entrepreneurship in the Middle East. What do you see there?
So this was the interesting one for me. So, like I said, the book is reflecting on, 25 years working in the region, but it also is a function of some travel I did before I was writing it. And one of the fascinating things is that as a result of the Arab uprisings and in the aftermath of the Arab uprisings, there was a tremendous rush of youthful agency and energy. Young people who either participated in the uprising or came of age in that uprising and the uprising period suddenly had this sense of, grasping for opportunities to remake their lives and their societies. Now, in many cases, those opportunities were very quickly closed, at least politically. But what's interesting is the way that some of that energy has gone instead, because it can no longer go into kind of political directions, has gone instead into economic ones. So you've seen this from a very low base, tremendous growth of the kind of startup sector. Now, partly it's just an economic thing, right? It is, here's an opportunity to kind of make some money. But it's also, I think, fundamentally a political thing as well, in that it is, for a certain number of young people, we are no longer going to wait for government to provide us with jobs. We're going to find them ourselves. And some of the economic enterprises they're engaged in also have a social or a political character. So it's people inventing apps that connect ordinary citizens to blood banks to get around the kind of bureaucratic impasses in the system. Or they create apps that allow an individual to monitor the state budget. Now, some of it's much more directly commercial than that. Now, we have to be very careful about it. Like I said, there's been massive investment in the sector. It's growing quickly, but it's from a low base. It's never going to provide the millions of jobs that some people may claim for it. Like the startup sector in other parts of the world, it'll produce more failures than it produces successes. But the thing that's interesting for me about it is the way it is disruptive of the existing economic order. And we often forget the economic component of the old order. We think of the politics, the military guys in control, the security services that buttress existing regimes. But just as much of a support other kind of is the economic system, the kind of limited economic system around regimes that provide them support. And in many ways, it were the it was the economic players of the old regime that were whispering, for example, in Sisi's ear in Egypt to say, we need to restore the old system, because it was their interests that were being lost. So it's disruptive of that. And one of the, I quote in the book, the kind of head of probably the most, one of the most successful Middle Eastern startups, souq.com, who actually says, look, one of the reasons we're successful is that we can create a new ecosystem, a new economic ecosystem, before the old system gets wise to it, before they understand, mm-hmm. because the old system is slow moving. Now, this is transformative more broadly because, one, it brings new economic players into the field. Two, it undermines the power of existing economic elites who have often been resistant or opponents of reform or change in the past, including political change. Three, it also has an impact. It starts to change societies within, because as ostensibly economic startups, they appear at first glance less threatening to existing regimes, who are, after all, interested in growing the private sector and making sure people have jobs, so they're not kind of protesting. And to do that, the startup sector demands kind of legislative change, which might appear innocuous in the first instance, but eventually has broader consequences and starts to kind of change societies and systems in very incremental ways that are still nevertheless very significant. So you look at somewhere like Egypt. Egypt is today more repressive, more closed as a political system than any time in its modern history, right? even under Nasser. Yet last year or the year before, I can't remember which now, the government passed a new bankruptcy legislation, which meant that if you get bankrupt, you don't necessarily go to jail. Now they did that ostensibly for very practical reasons, because we want to encourage the private sector, we want to encourage the kind of startup sector. But that's also a very significant mechanism that starts to add a bit of transparency, a bit of legal certainty around people's status in societies. And if it starts economic, it doesn't necessarily have to stay there. It can shift into other realms. So there is that broader transformative impact that the startup sector can have, slowly, incrementally, almost insidiously.
Final question for me, and then I'm going to open it up to all of you. Another striking aspect of the book for me is the relative absence of outsiders. The clues there in the title, Remaking the Middle East, how a troubled region may save itself.
Yeah.
I think for most of us who learn about the Middle East through the news media, we're used to thinking about it in terms of what others are doing in the region, what are the Americans up to, the Europeans, the Russians, and so on. That's not the narrative here. So can you say a bit more about the role, or the lack of it, of outside powers?
So this was also another kind of quite self-conscious decision to say, look, there are plenty of books and policy papers written about what the West should do in the Middle East. And I'm not saying that the West has played no role in the creation of the modern Middle East, or has no role to play in its kind of transformation. Quite the contrary. But there is so much commentary on that we need to kind of move beyond it and start thinking about, well, what is it the region is doing itself? And it also goes to that, the kind of that general perception that this is a hopeless region, and someone has to go in and go in and save it. And I think one of the really interesting things about the current era is the extent to which, it's not to say that there was no agency in the Middle East in the past, but new agency has been born. People are not waiting around for God, the dictator, or the military to kind of deliver anymore. There are still people like that in those societies, but there is much greater sense that people are just saying, you know what? We're not waiting for this anymore.
Sorry to interrupt, but presumably the Iraq War cured the US and the West generally of that impulse to rescue.
Yeah, well, it's the graveyard of grand schemes for regional transformation, whether it's democratic transformation or kind of strategic transformation, or even people who talk about, the need for Marshall Plans for the Middle East. Yeah. The one thing we have learned from Afghanistan and Iraq is that we aren't very good at this. We aren't very good at going in and kind of transforming a society. So now that's not to say we shouldn't play a role in assisting where possible, facilitating where possible, protecting where possible some of the indigenous force, positive indigenous forces for change that we see in the region. But that also means taking some very hard decisions about the way we approach foreign policy towards the Middle East. One of the fascinating things recently, in the last month, is watching the debate about the Iran deal. The thing that's revealing for me about that is that what it shows is the West is still primarily focused on the geopolitics of the Middle East. Now, you might say that's unsurprising. That's the habit that was born from the Cold War, even from the colonial period. We're interested in who's running states and who's on our side and who's not on our side. But think about it. It's remarkable when you think that over the last 15 years, the thing that has most preoccupied us in the Middle East, the crises, the humanitarian outflows, the threat of terrorism, all relate to the way the states in the region are governed. Almost none of them relate to the relationship between states, whether Iran is up or Saudi is down or the state of Israeli-Iranian relations. Everything is about the way these states are governed, yet the thing that still preoccupies us is the geopolitics.
Well, let me open it up to the audience now and invite your questions. You're welcome to identify yourself if you wish. Please ask questions rather than statements, and let's begin at the front.
My name's Terry Henderson. I'm just a very general member of the community. One thing we get in the media all the time is a division between Sunnis and Shia, which I understand goes back to the 7th or 8th centuries. Two prongs to my question. Is this comparable to Catholics and Protestants in Europe in the 17th and 18th, or 18th centuries when they were pretty well killing each other? And is the what's put in the media overblown, or is there a real schism that really has to be overcome?
I'll answer both questions in one way, in that I think it's overblown. That I think that we have, yes, you can trace the kind of the genealogy of the conflict back to the 7th century. But the reality is that over the course of that period since then, the fabric of relations between Sunni and Shia is rich, complex, sometimes marked by periods of conflict, sometimes marked by periods of cooperation, sometimes marked by periods of ambivalence. Far more consequential, in my view, is the way that political leaders use and mobilize sectarian divisions at the moment for their own political purposes. There is nothing innate in the current sectarian conflicts we've seen in the Middle East. There is nothing innately religious about them. In every instance, you can tie it back to the decision of a political leader to utilize those resources that will suit their political ambitions. And in a situation where there's great uncertainty, when there is often the breakdown of the old order, as there was in Iraq after the US invasion, naturally enough, communities fall back on the things that provide them with some security, and the sense of kind of sectarian identity sometimes does that. But in every case, this is something that is maintained, constructed, and utilized by sectarian leaders. And the evidence of that is today in Iraq, where you just had a parliamentary election where Muqtada al-Sadr, who was very used to using the sectarian weapon, very practiced in using the sectarian weapon in the past, is now portraying himself as an Iraqi nationalist. And that I think that underlines the extent to which this is something that is very much manipulated by leaders for their own political ends.
Which is an oddly hopeful message, right?
Yeah.
Because it reminds me of the debate about in the 90s about the Balkans, where President Clinton was fond of this phrase, ancient ethnic hatreds, which was really a way of saying, well, we can never solve this. We can never figure this out. But actually, it wasn't ancient.
Well, as a Croat, I can tell you that in the case of the Balkans, they were ancient, but it's different.
All right. I stand corrected. Please.
You seem to imply that the problems are basically within the region. As I see it, it is there was the interference historically that mm-hmm. created problems, and the problems are still there. And when we look at internally of how people support each other, racial groups, religious groups, etc., they don't take care of each other. They leave it to others. And so it seems the interference is almost, you know, transferred then to solving the problems from the region. It's it's quite strange.
It would be a brave observer of the, or analyst of the Middle East to suggest that the West or outside powers played no role in creating the current dysfunction. And the intent in what is a short book is not to suggest that. I mean, if I wrote a book which looked at both the positive and the negative sides of the ledger, the external and the internal role, it would be a lot longer than 27,000 words. So partly it's the choice of myself about what I'm going to focus on. And there are parts in the book which talk about the West's role in this dysfunction. But at the same time, and it might be a controversial thing to say, but it's also something that some of the people I talked to in the Middle East also said, that, for many in the region, it's now no longer about, we can't blame all of our problems on Western intervention. We have to take a look at the way our societies function, at the way our politics have functioned, and the way that we've created opportunities for Western policy, whether it's US or Europe or whatever, in the past, to exploit the weaknesses in our own societies, in our own systems. And it's that sense of taking our own responsibility and not simply waiting for our allies to kind of solve our problems. And one of the interesting things, again, you saw in the Egyptian uprising, was very early on, was a lot of the protesters articulating this view that, look, this is not about Israel-Palestine. This is not about our relationship with the West. And we don't want you here. This is about us solving our problems and taking responsibility for our problems. And there's also this tendency, which is kind of, which often gets exacerbated by the sometimes very lurid conspiracy theories you hear in the Middle East about how everything is either the fault or the result of a decision that the US has taken, or some malign external hand. The truth is, there is a lot more indigenous responsibility for both the good and the evil that occurs in the region than we often give credit for.
I just wondered if you had any comments about a future of multilateralism in the area, and how the sort of balance between Saudis, Iranians, what sort of future could there be looking on the positive side of a multilateral organisation in the Middle East?
Yeah, I mean, it's very difficult to see any kind of regional or multilateral organisation succeeding at the moment in the Middle East. I mean, if anything, the lines of division between states have sharpened. Few kind of regional kind of multilateral organizations that exist are themselves internally divided. You have in the case of the Gulf Cooperation Council, the isolation of Qatar, divisions between the Saudis and the Emiratis on one side, the Qataris on the other, and some of the others somewhere in the middle, the kind of Arab League. So finding a regional or multi or a kind of multilateral forum that plays a positive role in the region is going to be very difficult. When it comes to the Saudi-Iranian competition, one of the other points that I make in the book is, we think of it in terms of the Saudis and the Iranians are playing out their kind of proxy war, their proxy battle for influence around the region, in Yemen, in Syria, other parts of the region. And, it's a revival of an old kind of conflict that goes back, an old kind of rivalry that goes back even before the Iranian Revolution in 79. But I think one of the, again, and this is where because we tend to kind of privilege geopolitics above everything else, the real thing that's going to decide the competition between, for influence between Saudi Arabia and Iran is not going to be proxy wars in Yemen. It's going to be the race between the two countries to reform their economies and their political systems, because ultimately it's going to be that internal strength that's going to decide which country is the most influential. It's going to decide which country is the least susceptible to external interference. It's going to decide which country is dynamic and presents a vision to other parts of the region that, that others find attractive. That really is going to determine that kind of battle for influence much more than who wins in Yemen or even in Syria.
So who's winning that race? Or is it possible they're both losing?
I think at the moment they're kind of both... It's unclear. I mean, the Iranians now... it's very, very clear, to me at least, that the only reason that the most conservative parts of the Iranian regime agreed to the nuclear deal in the first place is because they understand that unless Iran ends its economic isolation, they are in deep trouble as a system. So there is a genuine threat to them. The end of the nuclear deal and the return to that isolation is a kind of a genuine problem for them.
Yes.
The Saudis have, under King Salman and his young son, have entered into a high-profile reform process that gets a lot of attention, and there's a lot of razzmatazz around it. But the results, it's very unclear what the results of that reform process are going to be, about how deep it really goes, how transformative it really is going to be, whether it's more words and marketing than it is kind of real. So in a sense, both regimes understand the need to renovate the system. Neither, I think, is making that much progress. And you can have debate about where they are relative to each other at the moment, but I would argue that generally neither is so far making much progress in making that renovation.
Richard.
Thanks, Richard Rigby. It's an obvious question, and you can disinvite me from dinner. But where does Israel fit in with all this? Or where do Israel and Palestine fit in?
Yeah. So sent the manuscript off for kind of blind peer reviewers, one of my peer reviewers came back and said, "You've completely underestimated the centrality of Israeli Palestine." And if I had written back to them, I would say, well, I did that on purpose because I simply don't believe it's central anymore. That's not to say that the kind of Palestinian cause doesn't resonate amongst many Arabs in the region. That's not to say that solving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict isn't important, mainly for Israelis and Palestinians. But the days when this was, if we're able to solve this conflict, then all the problems of the region would disappear. If that was ever true, which of course it never was, I think it's much less true today. And there's a recognition around the region of that. If you're a young Tunisian and you're thinking about a job, you're thinking about the transformation of society, you may have some sympathies for Palestinians, but you don't fundamentally believe, if you ever did, that solving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is going to do that much for you. I mean, Israel is in a kind of, at the moment at least, if you're Bibi Netanyahu, you feel you're in a pretty happy position. You're popular at home. The economy is doing pretty well. You've outmaneuvered the Palestinians. You're building ties with the leaders of some Arab states to an extent that people wouldn't have imagined. So, the relationship with Saudi has gone from being fairly covert to being fairly overt. And you have in the White House a president who is prepared to give you tremendous license. So things are looking pretty good. That's usually the point at which the Israelis overreach. And I think there is a real risk of that, and that overreach will produce a reaction that will be bad for Israel and bad for stability in the region.
What does overreach look like? Does it look like a military strike on Iran?
It may look like, not a military strike on Iran, but it may look like, a more adventurous policy. It's pretty adventurous in Syria already, but more extensive military action in Syria. It may mean the kinds of things that we're seeing vis-a-vis the Palestinians in Gaza. It may mean, and it says it's not so much, maybe overreach is the wrong term. Part of it is, in the past, kind of international pressure on Israel produced at least some measure of restraint. And some of that restraint is gone. And that, I think, is dangerous for the region. It's dangerous for Israel as well.
Rick Smith here, or what remains of him. Thanks, Anthony, for that, and congratulations on your book.
Thank you.
Just a question looking as far ahead as it's possible. That is a question about the future of those made-up states, the Disneylands, the Gulf states.
Mm-hmm.
Do they have a long-term future?
I think they do. I mean, and you have to go, you have to divide them. I mean, look, if there are some exceptions to my general thesis that the system across the region is decaying, albeit at different rates, there will be with some of those kind of Gulf city states, the kind of the not so much the UAEs, but some of the princely states that make up the United Arab Emirates, the Abu Dhabis and the Dubais, that have been tremendously successful as city states, but also have significant wealth and very small populations. So the equation is different there. And Qatar, to a similar degree, falls into that category. It's the slightly larger Gulf states where the equation of kind of resources to population is not quite in their favour. Saudi Arabia being the obvious case, Oman, Bahrain, Kuwait to a certain degree. I'm not a great believer in the thesis that kind of artificial states disappear, because let's face it, most of our states are artificial. They get created at some point. And one of the things that's proved incredibly durable in the Middle East, in the modern Middle East since its kind of creation, have been borders. And states have more or less mostly kind of survived. So I don't think there's a threat to the existence of those states. I think the main threat, and this mainly relates to the bigger ones, and particularly to Saudi Arabia, is their internal stability and the way they're governed. And, you know, an obvious retort on Saudi is, well, the Saudis are wealthy and they'll always kind of buy their way out of trouble. And even if they're not quite making as much money from oil as they used to. But I remind people of the point I made earlier. It's not about abject poverty that's driving people to revolt. It's about the failure to meet their expectations. And when their expectations are high, even a modest drop off in the reality of their lives, the fact that they now have to pay, they might have to pay taxes or have to pay more for petrol, can have an incredibly motivating impact on their willingness to simply sit back and accept what their regimes say. The other point I'd make there is one of the things that I think makes the current authoritarian regimes in the region less resilient than people think is that they have become tremendously reliant on repression, much more so than in the past. And that's a dangerous, that's a fragile pillar on which to build your authority, because it provokes reactions. And in the past, in the Middle East, we've seen far lower degrees of repression produce a reaction in terms of, you know, violent reaction in terms of terrorism, insurgencies. More repression, I think, is going to eventually produce more of a reaction. And I think that is a risk, particularly for a state like Saudi Arabia, but even more so some of the others in the region who have fallen in love, but who feel there's no other option but to become much more reliant on the stick, on coercion rather than co-option, partly because they can't afford to co-opt people, or they don't have the means to do it.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's going to see us out for this evening. If you have more questions for Anthony, please do join us outside for another drink. And you can approach Anthony there, and I'm sure he'll be happy to answer your questions and sign a copy of the book. There's still a stall outside, so if you haven't bought one already, please do, and Anthony will be happy to sign it for you. And also, just a quick reminder to please look out for our future events here at the National Gallery. We do them frequently, and I know all of you are getting our emails, so please join us here again.
Sam, before we go, mm. I need to say a few words of thanks firstly to the Lowy Institute and to the Executive Director, Michael Fullilove, for giving me the opportunity to do the book in the first place and allowing me a bit of time to do that. To Sam, who was a very insightful and sensitive editor, to Lydia Papandrea, the research editor at the Lowy Institute, who did a kind of wonderful job of proofing and of shepherding the thing through the publication process, and is, as I've said before, is my one exception to the general rule that no person is indispensable. To the people, to the people that read it, some of whom I know and I acknowledge in the book, and others who were anonymous, I'm also grateful. All of them made a great contribution to improving it. And thank you all again for coming this evening.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Please grab a copy outside if you haven't already. Thanks, Anthony.
Thanks.